Thank you, Josh. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. As you may hear, I'm from Texas, and born and brought up in Scotland, and had the great privilege of being called here to teach in the seminary about 10 years ago after pastoring in Scotland for about 13 years. And many's a sermon I've actually heard from this congregation through the ministries of Dr. Ferguson, Dr. Thomas, and others. And it's a kind of strange, wonderful feeling to be here where I've received a lot of spiritual nourishment and instruction. You're a greatly blessed congregation. And thank you for the opportunity to speak to you on this subject. It's one that I've had a long interest in. Being asked to do this again, I haven't done talks on it for quite a while because I kind of get a bit weary of it. But being asked to speak again made me restudy, read the most recent research. And for all my love of technology, I'm really scared as well. And I want to try and share some of what I've found with you and help us all to develop a healthier relationship with technology and help our children to do the same. And I'd like to begin with God's Word, reading in Daniel and chapter 1. You know the story well. Israelites carried off into Babylon, and there a few young Israelites are separated out to join the king's household, and they are to be inculcated into the culture and ways of Babylon. And these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and to them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, "I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink, for why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king." So Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, "Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. And let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies. And as you see fit, so deal with your servants." So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. We'll read the rest of that chapter tomorrow morning. Clearly here, 2,500 years ago, the Lord exiled his people in a very hostile culture, a culture that was uniformly opposed to everything that God's people stood for. And yet, as Jeremiah 14 makes clear, when God sent his people into Babylon, he said, "Build houses, open businesses, have children, and raise them for me." And they were to be raised like Daniel and his friends here, separate, in Babylon, but not of Babylon. And you see here Daniel owning this, standing up with his friends to be different in this hostile culture. And though we are not living in physical Babylon as Daniel and his friends and the people of God, yet we are living in digital Babylon. We're living in a digital culture that is all around us on every side, wherever we go, a culture that is largely, if not 99% hostile to spirituality in general and to Christianity in particular. Digital Babylon is at least as dangerous as physical and geographical Babylon. Maybe all the more so because it's not so obvious. Hundreds of thousands were taken into Babylon. And when the time came to return 70 years later, very, very few of the Israelites returned. They had been thoroughly Babylonized. And our challenge is to try and resist the same, because we and our children are being Babylonized, probably in much more subtle ways than Daniel and his friends were. So if we want to avoid this, and we want to avoid this for our children, we need to identify the dangers, see them clearly for what they are, know what steps to take to be separate from them, and know what to do to build another culture within our digital world. And to do that, I want to do this in three sessions. First of all, we're going to look at the digital dangers. I think all of us are vaguely and generally aware that, hey, this is not good. There are things happening we don't like. But I doubt many, if any of us, really know how bad the situation really is. For ourselves, yes, but especially for our children. So although this evening is going to be rather, you might say, negative, I think it's absolutely vital to do this, to sensitize us, to alert us, to get the alarm bells ringing in order that we give more attention to, for example, the second talk, Digital Detox, which is a step-by-step plan to separate ourselves and our children from digital Babylon. And then thirdly, Digital Diet, which is a more positive look, like how do we use digital technology in a healthy way at different ages and stages of life, and how do we model that for our children? Getting digital technology under control is, I believe, the key to excellence in our chosen callings and in our children's lives. Nothing else is as important to the financial, emotional, relational, and intellectual success and thriving of us and our children. If you want to give your child a competitive advantage in the world, the greatest gift you can give them is to help them get digital technology under control, and I hope to prove that to you this evening. But of course, as parents, we're not just interested in our children's careers and their studies, or even their marriages. We're interested in their souls. We want them to thrive spiritually. And it is as important in that area to get digital technology under control. If we want to grow in grace and in the knowledge of Jesus Christ, then getting digital technology harnessed is the most important challenge that we face. I'm 100% convinced that there is nothing more important for individual Christians, for Christian families, and for the Christian church than to become better stewards of God's gift of digital technology. This is what's going to make or break our Christian lives. This is what's going to make or break our families. This is what's going to make or break our churches for decades to come. And it's not just a problem for our kids, it's a problem for us all. In fact, I believe the single greatest deciding factor for our kids' digital health is the model that we put in front of them ourselves. So, we'll be addressing adult problems as well as children's struggles. It's a multi-dimensional problem. There are therefore multi-dimensional solutions. It's going to involve some eye gouging and some hand amputating. But I really believe it's worth it. So worth it that I think we'll look back, if we're spared another 10, 15, 20 years, that we'll look back in horror and say, what were we doing? And this is not just Christians. You'll see as I go through some of this research tonight, this is society-wide. You do not need to be a Christian to see the dangers of digital technology. So I want to, obviously as a pastor, I want to focus on the spiritual problems, but I want to show the danger, the damage that digital technology is doing in various parts of our lives. We've gained much from it, but we've also lost a lot as well. It's enhanced our lives. Some of us wouldn't be here without it. But it's also killing our lives. So we want to begin this evening by looking at digital dangers. And I want you to notice, first of all, that digital technology is killing our brains. It's killing our brains. Here's an article, How Tech Ate the Media and Our Minds. And in it, it presents science which says our brains have been literally swamped and reprogrammed. We are spending around 6 hours a day consuming digital media. And as a result, the human attention span has fallen from 12 seconds to 8 seconds since the year 2000. Incidentally, the goldfish's attention span is 9 seconds. We're killing our brains. In this report, The Great Disconnect, Megahertz to Megahertz, it reports that for a toddler, an hour of television equals a 7% decrease in classroom engagement and a 13% decrease in weekly physical activity. Children who are engaged in violent video games are literally changing the shape of their brains. Those who are engaged in this daily show less activity in the prefrontal portions of the brain, which are involved in inhibition, concentration and self-control, so that's getting smaller, and more activation in the amygdala. So this is getting bigger, the area that's involved in emotional arousal. Those who engage regularly in multitasking, and their IQ scores decline similar to if they had smoked marijuana or stayed up all night. Multiple device use, you know what we do, we're watching the game, and we're on our phones, and we're on our iPads, multiple device use, produces less brain density in the region responsible for empathy, cognitive, and emotional control. You can see why it's headlined Megahertz to Megahertz. We are literally hurting our brains. We're also killing our concentration. When office workers are asked, how many times an hour are you checking email? The average that most people say is 10 to 15. When scientists actually put devices on their machines that count the number of times they actually do it, it's in the region of 30 to 40 times an hour. It's killing our concentration. One in four people check their smartphone every 30 minutes. One in five check it every 10 minutes. The most recent research into teens have them, on average, looking at their phones between 80 and 100 times a day. You can see how this is just breaking our lives into lots and lots and lots of tiny little segments. So there's no exercising of the concentration muscle. It's just dying. In this article, Why You Need Less Noise for Your Work and Your Health, it's a study at the University of California. And it found that knowledge workers have focus periods of just 11 minutes on average in between interruptions. In fact, it's been found if you need to focus, work is just about the worst place to try and do it. 90% of students admit to using their devices for non-class activities during class times an average of 11 times a day. And less than 8% said they never do so. In this article, which is headlined, "It's a Problem Literature Reading is Low, Digital Temperance Can Help," it says that in 2015, less than half of Americans reported reading at least one work of literature in a year. That's down from 57% in 1982. And somebody compared it to this. It's like if you go to the gym, you have a choice. You can take exercises that will create lots of really fit, small muscles, or you can choose exercises that are going to grow a select number of very big muscles. So the exercise you do really determines your shape. And really what this is telling us is that the exercises we do with our brains shape our brains. And if we choose to use our brains for lots and lots of tiny, little, small segments of reading, little bite-sized things, then that's the kind of brain you'll get, and you'll never be able to read a book again. And you'll certainly never be able to do a lot of deep thinking. So it's killing our concentration. It's killing our memories. You know, some of us, at least when we're growing up, to carry scripture with you, you memorized it. Now, you just carry a phone. What's the point in memorizing? All you need to know is like a couple of words. You enter into Google and you're away. I remember growing up, most of us had Bibles that there were like colored maps. You know, you'd marks here and there, you'd highlights, and it was actually mapped into your brain. You could remember physical pages. You knew where to find verses. Regular reading and going over these pages, it left imprints on your brain. It made it hugely helpful when you're preparing sermons, when you're witnessing, and we've lost that because none of that mapping occurs on digital devices. We're killing our memories. We think we know, but really all we know is how to put in google.com. We know where to find things, but we don't know things. It's also killing our problem-solving and our creativity. You know, in the past, you had a question, you had a puzzle, you thought you knew something, but you couldn't quite pull it out of your mind. You had to sit there, you had to think about it, you had to wrestle, you had to dig into your mind, you had to go deep to pull it out, or you had to bring together, okay, I know a bit of knowledge in this area of life, and I know a bit of knowledge in this area of life, and somehow or other, bringing these two things together is going to help me solve this problem. But now, all of that information is on the net. I teach classes, and the students say, you know, there's really no point in us taking notes because we can get all this on the internet. And then they'll say, but really there's no point even in being examined in this because, you know, we're going to have all this at our fingertips in our studies anyway. There's no wrestling with problems. There's no creativity. We just Google it. This article here, "Are You Suffocating Your Creativity?" highlights two problems. The amount of technological distraction and the lack of boredom. These two things are key for any kind of creativity, for any imagination. No distraction and boredom. Large tracts of time where you've got nothing to do. That's when creativity sparks. That's why so many discoveries are found in the bath or in the shower or, you know, in the middle of just daydreaming. The brain seems to need these kinds of moments, these times for any aha, eureka moments to occur. We're killing our sleep. Our health is suffering because of a shortening, a shallowing, and an interrupting of our sleep. Excess technology use, and especially late evening technology use, damages the quality and the length of our sleep. Kids are consuming about 11 hours of digital media a day, with a huge impact on the quantity and the quality of their sleep. I'll show you some graphs shortly which show frightening drop-offs in teen sleeping hours, beginning sometime around about 2010, 2011, and all the experts are agreed that it coincides with the mass adoption of the iPhone amongst teens. And it's like the average sleep went from 9 to 7 hours in just a couple of years. In this article, has the smartphone destroyed a generation? I think that's the one by Jean Twenge, the author of iGen, which is really worthwhile reading. She asks, has the smartphone destroyed a generation? Although teens need about 9 hours of sleep, she says the average is now less than 7. That's 57% more teens were sleep deprived in 2015 than in 1991. Teens who spend 3 or more hours a day on electronic devices are 28% more likely to get less than 7 hours of sleep. Children who use a media device right before bed are more likely to sleep less than they should, more likely to sleep poorly, and more than twice as likely as to be sleepy the next day. It shortens sleep, it shallows sleep, and it interrupts sleep. And sleep is so vital for physical and emotional health. The lack of it, sleep deprivation, is now linked to compromised thinking and reasoning, susceptibility to all sorts of illness, weight gain, high blood pressure, depression, and anxiety. It's killing our sleep, and as a result, it's killing our emotional and our physical health. It's also killing our identity. People's identities are now multiple and false, usually, as various personas are created and cultivated on social media. Kids try one image one day, another image the next, another image. They're being shaped and formed continually by the likes they get or the lack of likes. Whether people love their Instagrams or not determines really how they view themselves, how they dress themselves, how they portray themselves. We've forgotten who we really are. I want to show you a video here by Simon Sinek, speaking on the effect of technology on our kids.
Right? Now let's add in technology. We know that engagement with social media and our cell phones releases a chemical called dopamine. That's why when you get a text, it feels good, right? So, you know, we've all had it where you're feeling a little bit down or feeling a bit lonely. And so you send out 10 texts to 10 friends, you know, hi. Because it feels good when you get a response, right? Right? It's why we count the likes. It's why we go back 10 times to see if my Instagram is growing slower. Did I do something wrong? Do they not like me anymore? Right? The trauma for young kids to be unfriended, right? Because we know when you get it, you get a hit of dopamine, which feels good. It's why we like it. It's why we keep going back to it. Dopamine is the exact same chemical that makes us feel good when we smoke, when we drink, and when we gamble. In other words, it's highly, highly addictive, right? We have age restrictions on smoking, gambling, and alcohol, and we have no age restrictions on social media and cell phones, which is the equivalent of opening up the liquor cabinet and saying to our teenagers, hey, by the way, this adolescence thing, if it gets you down... But that's basically what's happening. That's basically what's happening, right? That's basically what happened. You have an entire generation that has access to an addictive, numbing chemical called dopamine through social media and cell phones as they're going through the high stress of adolescence. Why is this important? Almost every alcoholic discovered alcohol when they were teenagers. When we're very, very young, the only approval we need is the approval of our parents. And as we go through adolescence, we make this transition where we now need the approval of our peers. Very frustrating for our parents, very important for us. It allows us to acculturate outside of our immediate families into the broader tribe, right? It's a highly, highly stressful and anxious period of our lives, and we're supposed to learn to rely on our friends. Some people, quite by accident, discover alcohol and numbing effects of dopamine to help them cope with the stresses and anxieties of adolescence. Unfortunately, that becomes hardwired in their brains. And for the rest of their lives, when they suffer significant stress, they will not turn to a person, they will turn to the bottle. Social stress, financial stress, career stress. That's pretty much the primary reasons why an alcoholic drinks, right? What's happening is because we're allowing unfettered access to these dopamine-producing devices and media, basically it's becoming hardwired. And what we're seeing is as they grow older, too many kids don't know how to form deep, meaningful relationships. Their words, not mine. They will admit that many of their friendships are superficial. They will admit that their friends, that they don't count on their friends, they don't rely on their friends, they have fun with their friends, but they also know that their friends will cancel on them if something better comes along. Deep, meaningful relationships are not there because they never practice the skill set, and worse, they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress. So when significant stress starts to show up in their lives, they're not turning to a person, they're turning to a device, they're turning to social media, they're turning to these things which offer temporary relief. We know, the science is clear, we know that people who spend more time on Facebook suffer higher rates of depression than people who spend less time on Facebook, right? These things balanced. Alcohol is not bad. Too much alcohol is bad. Gambling is fun. Too much gambling is dangerous, right? There's nothing wrong with social media and cell phones. It's the imbalance, right? If you're sitting at dinner with your friends and you're texting somebody who's not there, that's a problem. That's an addiction. If you're sitting in a meeting with people you're supposed to be listening to and speaking, and you put your phone on the table, face up or face down, I don't care, that sends a subconscious message to the room that you're just not that important to me right now, right? That's what happens. And the fact that you cannot put it away is because you are addicted, right? If you wake up and you check your phone before you say good morning to your girlfriend, boyfriend, or spouse, you have an addiction. And like all addiction, in time, it'll destroy relationships, it'll cost time, and it'll cost money, and it'll make your life worse, right? So you have a generation growing up with lower self-esteem that doesn't have the coping mechanisms to deal with stress, right? Now you add in the sense of impatience.
This is not a Christian. This is just, you know, somebody observing. Just seeing the evidence in front of his eyes, somebody who mixes a lot with young kids. And this study that he referred to, a rigorous study confirms the more you use Facebook, the worse you feel. It's exposure to very carefully curated images from other people's lives are making our kids feel inadequate. There's a negative self-comparison. And the sheer quantity of social media interaction detracts from meaningful, real-life experiences. It's also killing our mental health. Constant beeps, buzzes, updates, reduce undisturbed time for the brain to rest and repair. Unlike other revolutionary media like TV, like the radio, this is ubiquitous. We didn't go out for work with the TV under our arms. We now have this with us all the time. Even we wait at the stoplight, we're in a line, we're not prepared to even a second without stimulating our brains. And our brains just are not built for this level of constant, high-level stimulation. And as a result, it's really damaging our mental health. This article is headlined, "Parents Need to Get Serious About Saving the Next Generation from Internet Addiction." It quotes research which shows that iGens are actually more physically safe than you and I were growing up. There are less car crashes. There's less alcohol. There's less sex, believe it or not. That's what the research is showing. But their emotional and mental lives are a mess. They're more depressed. They're prone to social media bullying. They're more likely to commit suicide. They struggle with body image and confidence. They struggle to foster healthy, wholesome friendships and romance. And I don't know if you've been reading the news this week, but there's been a big study published with terrifying statistics on the accelerating rate of anxiety amongst teens. It's rising at 20% a year. This is unprecedented. And really nobody's getting to the root of it, I don't feel. There's lots and lots of theories, but there seems to be a real terror at times of actually pointing to like the obvious problem, in that there's just no rest for these young minds at any point of the day or even the night. 6 million American teens grapple with an anxiety disorder of some kind. The three main reasons given are more pressure, more stimulus, and more trickle-down stress. And where do all these three things come from? It's coming from digital media. This researcher said they're in a cauldron of stimulus they can't get away from or don't want to get away from or don't know how to get away from. And that's why that earlier article was headlined, "Parents Need to Get Serious About Saving the Next Generation from Internet Addiction." Instagram is the worst social media network for mental health. It's been described as more addictive than cigarettes and alcohol. It's no longer possible to ignore it, says the Royal Society for Public Health, when talking about young people's mental health issues. Both Instagram and Snapchat are very image-focused and appears they are driving feelings of inadequacy and anxiety in young people. It's also killing our modeling, our example, what we are putting in front of our children ourselves. In this piece of research, parents' mobile use harms family life. Say high school students. This is the young people themselves who are saying this. More than a third of 11 to 18-year-olds said that they had asked their children to, they'd asked their parents to stop using their devices. Of pupils who had asked their parents to put down their phones, 46% said their parents took no notice, while 44% felt upset and ignored. 82% of students felt mealtime should be device-free. This is young people. This is what's at their heart. Children's greatest worry about their own online use was lack of sleep, with 47% highlighting it as a major concern. This headmaster of this elite school which represents a lot of leading private schools, said it was time for parents, teachers and pupils to rewrite the rule book on mobile devices, which have become an integral part of school work and play. Our poll shows that children are aware of many of the risks associated with overuse of technology, but they need the adults in their lives to set clear boundaries and role model sensible behaviour. I remember growing up as a young kid, I would often come down in the morning and I'd find my dad there with his Bible open. And that stopped me. When that memory came back to me a few years ago, I stopped using my iPad for my Bible reading. Because if my kids come down, yeah, I'm reading the Bible on the iPad, but they don't know that. And so we've got to think, what message are we communicating? What model are we giving them? What are they seeing? We are imprinting ways of living upon them with our daily lives. This is an interesting one. This picture went viral. It was a daycare center in Houston I don't know if you can read it properly, but it says, "You are picking up your child. Get off your phone. Your child is happy to see you. Are you happy to see your child? We have seen children trying to hand their parents their work they completed, and the parent is on the phone. We have heard a child say, 'Mommy, mommy, mommy,' and the parent is paying more attention to their phone than their own child. It is appalling. Get off your phone." It's killing our modeling. It's killing our friendships. It's killing our fellowship. It's killing listening skills and speaking abilities. It's killing face-to-face communication and inter-family relationships. It's been found that social media is increasing loneliness. 2 hours of social media use a day double the chances of a person feeling social isolation. This article, "I Am iPhone: How Our Tech Endangers Our Relationships." This is a family therapy expert. And he said, you know, it used to be family therapists would say when you're working with a couple, there are always 3 people in the room to consider: the man, the woman, and the relationship itself. The more I've begun to work with couples, the more I've realized that this maxim is actually a half-truth. There are 3 people in the room, but far too often the third person is one partner's smartphone. Let me show you another video. This time, Denzel Washington.
So what is the long-term effect of too much information? The polarization of the electorate? A meaner spiritness.
False information as well, because the whole fake news thing.
Pick one. It's not just one. That's the flavor of the day. Every day is something else. People have to understand, are you using your device or is your device using you? Can you put it down? Can you turn it off?
You're talking about literally the places people get their information from.
I don't care what information. Pick one. Phone, television. You know, it used to be news. Now it's opinions. Oh, glasses. We have 3 experts on the right, 3 on the left. Let's discuss. Ooh, light bulbs. We have 3 experts on the right. That's not news. That's opinions. Well, over and over and over. Cycle, 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 cycle. What is the long-term effect of too much information? If you're sitting there and you're thinking it's the gospel, what I'm saying to people is, to all of us, I'm not knocking the phone. What I'm saying is we have to understand. We have to at least ask ourselves, around the world, you, here in England, wherever you are, what is it doing to us?
Again, it's not a believer, but asking the most important questions that can be asked. This is a fascinating article, "YouTube is My Father," and it was highlighting how, you know, growing up, you had a problem, you went, "Hey, Dad, can you help me here?" When was the last time, Dad, you heard that? YouTube is now their dad. They have a problem, they just go to YouTube and watch a video. Again, you think of the long-term impact of that on that relationship, on that dependency, on that bond that's being entirely reshaped by technology. I think I've referred to this one already. This is the research by Jean Twenge. The smartphone generation, a statistical portrait. And just, you don't need to get all the details here, just get the general. See how around about 2010, iPhones released in 2007. And there's you begin to see a decline. But notice about 2010, 2011, we go off the cliff here. Times of week, teenagers go out without their parents. Right? Percentage of 12th graders who drive. Percentage of teenagers who go out on dates. Some of you think that's a good thing, I know, but it's just what's behind this? More likely to feel lonely. Less likely to get enough sleep. You see how it's destroying us? Damaging us, at least. It's also killing our privacy. Every moment is now a public moment. Everything has to be shared, instantly uploaded to the world for instant likes and feedback. We don't have much of a private life anymore as things are lived out in the public arena. Making mistakes, therefore, are very public too. Hard to erase when you've uploaded it to the World Wide Web for posterity. There's also, of course, the gathering of data, which is going on undetected all the time. We don't yet know how that will be used against us. But this sense of always being in the spotlight is changing people's self-perception and self-portrayal of themselves. It's turning everything really into a show. Ends up shaping our spiritual lives as well. This article here, Why Our Son Doesn't Have a Smartphone, the author Trevin Wax said the real reason is because we think his middle school years will be better spent without one. The answer I've given over and over again is this: I want you to be free from middle school drama when you're at home. It used to be, you know, your kid was in the bedroom, they were safe. Now in the bedroom, it's one of the most dangerous places in the world because the world is coming into them via their smartphones. It's killing our time. I don't think I need to go into that much, but the typical person by their early 20s, and that's in this report, Megahertz to Megahertz, you can download that on the internet. The typical person by their early 20s will have spent more than 30,000 hours on the internet or playing video games. That's 3.5 years on the internet playing games or using technology by their early 20s. Children now spend more time with the media than they do with their family, in school, or sleeping. It's killing our self-control. So much so that now it's being spoken of in terms of digital heroin. I think Simon Sinek talked about this, the drug effect of technology, that technology affects the brain the same way that cocaine does. It's so hyper-arousing that it raises dopamine levels, the feel-good neurotransmitter most involved in the addiction dynamic, and that it raises it as much as sex does. And that's why Dr. Peter Wybrow, director of neuroscience at UCLA, calls screens electronic cocaine. Chinese researchers call it digital heroin. The Handbook of Internet Addiction by Dr. Kimberly Young states that 18% of college-age students suffer from tech addiction. This book here, again, you might have seen this in New York Times bestseller list, Glow Kids by Nicholas Kadaras. He writes, he's worked with over 1,000 teens in the past 15 years and has concluded that the old axiom of an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure is especially true when it comes to tech addiction. Once a kid, he says, has crossed the line into true tech addiction, treatment can be very difficult. Indeed, I found it easier to treat heroin and crystal meth addicts than Lost in the Matrix video gamers or Facebook-dependent social media addicts. That's why he calls it the addiction that's worse than alcohol or drug abuse. In this article, Facebook Obsession and the Anguish of Boredom, it says Facebook addicts driving a car are more likely to respond faster to a push notification alert on their phone than to street signs. Where is our self-control going? It's killing our purity. I think that's probably what's at the forefront of our minds when we think of the internet and our children. The accessibility of pornography, the affordability of it, the anonymity of it. It's the three A's that are combining in a fatal way. Accessibility, affordability, and anonymity. But it's not just pornography. It's the amount of sexting that's going on as well. So our children are themselves becoming pornographers. It's not just that they are using pornography. They are pornographers. Some of them, way too many of them, frightening numbers of them. There's an article here. You don't need to see the details of this. This is a report that came out. It's not spiritual. It's not Christian. It's simply research done by scientists on the effect of pornography. And it's split into brain, heart, and world. And you see, like, it's just line after line after line after line of the damage that's being done. Far less consider the spiritual damage of pornography. And again, this is an increasing trend. We're finding in just totally secular, godless writers, scientists, doctors, have just the level of concern is flashing blue lights all over the place. Three things parents can do to keep your child from sexting. This is the sixth major health concern among children. It ranks just below child abuse and is of more concern than teen pregnancy and school violence. Again, you can download that Barna report on the sexting crisis. They found that teens and young adults said not recycling is more immoral than viewing pornographic images. They also placed thinking negatively about someone with a different point of view as a much worse activity than viewing pornography. And the stories are legion. We don't have time to go into them, but just the number of kids being caught in terrible cycles of sexting from Christian homes as well. The stats are something like 60% of kids have received a sext and 40% have created them. This article here, why it's terrible news that millennials are having less sex. You know, we might think, hey, that's good. But actually, when you look at the reasons, it's largely because pornography has taken the place of real life sex and is disincentivizing people from pursuing real relationships. We're losing our downtime. I don't have time to go into that. It's killing our finances. When you think of the amount of time lost of productivity, that's lost money as well. According to a 2015 report, distractions, this one here, distractions annually eat up 759 hours per worker. It's killing our life. You've got all these statistics about texting and driving. How many young people are in their grave because of technology, because of a silly text that arrived or a silly text they were trying to send. The police view this as an epidemic. And in a report on this, it said the texting virus is far more lethal than flu or Zika. It's killing far more of our children than either of these. It's killing our spiritual life. 8,000 Christians were surveyed by Desiring God about their social media routines. More than half of them, 54%, admitted to checking a smartphone within minutes of waking. When asked whether they were more likely to check email and social media before or after spiritual disciplines on a typical morning, 73% said before. Also, you think of the way we are learning how to read on our phones, the scanning that we do, the skimming. And when that becomes a habit, how hard it is when we go to our Bibles to slow down, to pause, to think deeply. It's killing our spiritual lives. It's killing our meditation. Very few are spending enough time to meditate. Bible reading is good. Bible meditation is where God really does his work. Heart work, and it's not happening. Again, maybe I can take the time to just show one video. I don't know why there are subtitles on this, but you don't need to look at them.
You know what? We can run to 1,000 things. You can quickly call somebody on your phone. Just every one of you, just about. You have a phone right in your pocket, right in your purse. You can, you know, it's difficult to mourn when all of a sudden you get a text message and then you respond to it. I mean, right at such a time where you've sinned and you're actually beginning to feel something and have some deep and real dealings with the Lord, and suddenly you hear a phone beep. And you actually respond to it. I'll tell you, one of the reasons we don't go so deep and we don't mourn so deeply and we don't weep so bitterly and we don't contemplate things like David did is because we're so caught up in the trivialities of our, you know what, there's a time to turn off your computer, turn off your phone. Guys, When I was a teenager, phones had cords that went to the wall. We didn't even have phones you could walk around the house with. There were no phones in cars yet. Cell phones weren't even, that was on Star Trek. I'm saying this because people actually have, for a long time, lived without these things. There's a time to shut them off and get alone with the Lord. If you can't do that, you're not going to know the victories of the men and women who have gone really deep with the Lord. That's just a truth. If you've got to take a 12-gauge shotgun and put a slug hole through the front of your television in order to get alone with the Lord, then do it.
And maybe that's just where I can leave it. I've showed how digital technology is killing so many areas of our lives and our children's lives. Trying to climax here in how it's killing us spiritually in the areas that are most important, that are at the core of real thriving and success in life. And it's that kind of radical actions that we have to begin to consider when we think of the danger, when we think of the damage that's being done to ourselves, being done to our children. This is something that is literally killing us in so many areas of our lives. And you know, there, I've got three articles there just in the last few days. These are people, this is the guy that invented the Facebook like button. right? And he is cutting himself and his children off from technology. This is the guy that invented the smartphone. He thinks he's the guy that destroyed, he's worried his grandkids will think he's the guy that's destroyed society. We could go on and on, but I hope I've left you with that RIP image that we should put beside our phones regularly and really face the reality of what these devices are doing to us, what we're letting them do to us, and try and, you know, remember what Daniel said. He purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, and therefore requested the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. And it's this kind of courageous, radical, clear decision making that is required. And we'll look at some of these decisions tomorrow, God willing. So we try to rebuild, but I hope I've sent you home tonight with some alarm bells ringing. And even if you don't sleep very well tonight, I'm okay with that. Because we need to be disturbed. As I've looked at this again, after a number of years not studying it, it's terrified me. And it's challenged me personally. I have work to do myself.